Welcome to 5 Lives to 50, the sustainability podcast for product managers. I am Shelley Metcalf, and I'm here with my two co-hosts, Jim Fava and Neil D'Souza. And joining us today on this episode is Ethan Soloviev, the Chief Innovation Officer at HowGood. HowGood is an independent research company and SaaS, or Software as a Service data platform, and they have the world's largest database on food product sustainability. Welcome, Ethan. Thanks for joining us today.
So glad to be here.
Well, this is the first time we've had a guest from a technology company on the podcast. Could you tell us a bit about what HowGood is and who it serves?
Absolutely. HowGood, as you mentioned, has the world's largest database on food product and ingredient sustainability. We're kind of a non-traditional startup in that we're 17 years old right now. So we've really spent the better part of two decades building out a massive picture of what global supply chains look like and what are the impacts that happen in three key areas: carbon, nature, and human rights. From that massive amount of data that we've gathered for 33,000 ingredients, we've built up the capability to automatically, using AI, calculate the impact of any food ingredient or product in the world. We've built it all into a software platform that is, I think, fun and easy to use. And we have 6 of the 10 largest food companies in the world using the platform to understand their impacts and to automate reduction strategies. We have major retailers around the world, from Ahold Delhaize in the USA to Carrefour in the Middle East. And we even have ingredient suppliers like Ingredion and the Kerry Group, who use the platform to understand their impacts and communicate downstream to their consumers. So overall, you can really almost think of HowGood as a social network for impact data on food and agriculture. So it's the place where the industry comes together, whether you're a formulator or a procurement specialist or somebody in marketing and sales or a sustainability team needing to do reporting. Everyone comes to us for a single source of sustainability data truth so that they can coordinate, collaborate, network, engage with suppliers to transform the impacts of their products.
So thinking about the broader picture, you're bringing all these groups together. What do you think the role technology does play? And because it sounds like you're playing a role already, but what role do you think it plays for these food formulators and food companies? And what is it doing for them to achieve sustainability?
Well, maybe I'll just tell a little story that is part of how we got to where we're at now to answer that question. So I met with somebody, this was a number of years ago, it was in San Francisco. It was at a collab sort of week-long sprint event. And I met somebody from Danone who said, look, I have 1,000 product formulators globally at Danone. And every day they are innovating and they are renovating new yogurts, new plant-based beverages. And those people, many of them really care about sustainability, but many of them weren't trained in it. They are food scientists. They are formulators. They are making delicious, beautiful food, but they don't necessarily have the information and the data to create a circular food product or create a regenerative food product. They have a desire to, and more we're being asked from a corporate level to improve or to make every new renovation, you know, have a lower carbon footprint, or even to know the carbon footprint of our products. But I can't send every single one of these formulators through a master's or a PhD in sustainability. How can we help them more quickly? And I said, well, you know, I think we actually have all the data for that. So if we could use technology to put it at their fingertips, even before going to the bench, that should be able to speed everything up. And that was the inception. That was the idea that launched Lattice, which is HowGood software platform, was basically to use technology to put the data at everybody's fingertips. So in the same way that you would look at the different physical qualities, the different taste qualities of an individual ingredient, the same way you might think about, well, what's the price differential going to be if I swap from this one to that one? It, just like you know and have information on those factors, we thought, well, let's just put the carbon footprint, the water footprint, the biodiversity impact, the labor risk, the processing energy use, the animal welfare. Let's just have clear quantitative data in that format right at formulators' fingertips. Because I actually think formulators are at a very potent and powerful place to change the food system, much more so than I think are often given credit to them. What formulators do and how they create products, like, that's such a huge, potent spot to change upstream impacts because of where impacts actually come from, which I think we'll talk a bit more about as we go.
I think you mentioned two very interesting words, Ethan. One was circular food products and regenerative food products. Could you tell us what those mean?
If you look at the definition of a circular economy, most of the time for food, they're pointing to regenerative and regenerative agriculture as one of the main routes to create a circular economy of food. I mean, there are aspects of design, there's aspects of packaging that come into circular, but really most impacts in food happen not in the manufacturing plant, not in the packaging, not in the transportation, but they happen upstream. They happen where food is grown. And that's where regenerative agriculture plays a huge role. So to focus on regeneration, the key concept there is for a long time, at least 100, probably, 1,000, but really the last 100 years, the production of food has had a massive negative impact on the world. Emitted lots of carbon, destroyed soil, deforested landscape, killed different species, poisoned people, poisoned waterways. And in many ways, still does. It still does have those deleterious effects. We still have a dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico. Right? We still have significant loss of species. Food emits 33% of the carbon emissions in the world, the greenhouse gas emissions, but it's responsible for a much larger percentage, like 80% of all freshwater use, and a huge percent of the biodiversity loss that's happening is from food and agriculture. So that's, you could call business as usual agriculture or degenerative agriculture. And that's most of what's out there. And so there's been some good focus in the last two decades to try to move away from that and towards a sustainable agriculture. A sustainable agriculture would be kind of like a net zero impact. But really, who just wants to sustain? If somebody asks you about your relationship with your sweetheart or your spouse, and they said, how's the relationship? And you said, it's sustainable. Is that really what we're going for? Or if you're on your deathbed and somebody says, what impact did you have in this world in your life? You said, about net zero. that's not really enough. And so regeneration steps beyond that. The idea with regeneration is we go to net positive. We're not just doing no harm. We're uplifting people who are growing food. We're enhancing biodiversity. We're capturing carbon in the soil and fighting against climate change. Regeneration generates new potential and doesn't just get us to sort of like a midpoint of sustainability. It's actually possible in food in a way that it isn't in other industries. So like transportation or buildings, you can reduce harm, you can reduce impact, you can get towards like a zero point, but it's really hard to do positive. Somehow you got to build the vehicle and drive it around or build the ship and sail it around. You can get to zero in it, but you can't quite get positive. Food and agriculture is this incredible opportunity where you can do good. You can add more carbon to the soil than you take out. You can have more life in a place. You can have richer, more delicious recipes and meals and food products coming out than was there before. You can heal degraded land while growing food. And so that's really why I focus on regeneration. That's really why Howgood says, let's set spectrums where you can track your progress towards that regenerative impact in the world.
Is there a framework that you guys have for what are the different aspects of regenerative food production and a kind of recipe, so to speak, right? So imagine people who are creating both the ones who are growing food, I think is one aspect, but the ones who are using them in recipes. What should they be looking for as indicators for what a regenerative food ingredient would be like?
Okay, well, you asked kind of two questions there. Both are really good questions. One is like, is there a framework or playbook to work with to get you there? And to that, I would say, yes. I've written a couple papers that lay out sort of a big picture framework of how to think about and move from degeneration to regeneration. And then in terms of food product creation, one of the places actually that is interesting that I'll point to because it popped to mind when you said framework is I did a webinar earlier this year on artificial intelligence, on AI for food. And in that, I followed the course of a food product right from the kind of ideation phase through piloting, prototyping, through the sort of scale up, through the procurement that's needed, all the way to the end, the marketing. And in that case, I was talking about, here's the artificial intelligence tools you could use at each of those steps. But really what I was going towards is how do you transform the food system through each one of those individual steps. And so I'll just say that webinar is freely available. We can put it in the show notes so you can sort of see that particular framework, which is like basically how to use AI to regenerate food production from a formulator's point of view in a lot of ways. But then it gets to your second question of like, what's the indicator of a regenerative ingredient? Which is such a cool question. And the first thing I would say is there's not many. There's like not actually a lot out there. It's not like, you know, 10% of the proverbial formulator's supermarket shelf or of the materials you can procure from many of your suppliers. It's not even 1% of global supply of food ingredients that I would say are actually achieving a regenerative impact. So there are some out there. There are some certifications you can look to of varying levels of sort of depth, but there's, you know, a couple that I point to is there's a regenerative organic certification. There's a certification for animal products that's called Land to Market. Those are great to look for, but certifications alone aren't going to be sufficient because there's just, again, there's not enough supply in any which way or form, especially certified, to kind of just switch to a regenerative product. So really what it means to find a regenerative ingredient is you actually have to think beyond the way that you currently think about just finding the ingredient that solves your problem. Instead, you have to start looking at and collaborating with your whole company internally and then a whole network externally. You are going to have to help generate the supply of regenerative ingredients for the types of products that you were working with. And that takes a broader collaboration, but it takes a more fun, creative thinking that I think formulators have, but maybe haven't always been empowered with data to do. So the path to find regenerative ingredients is you must help generate regenerative ingredients out in the world through broader cooperation.
Ethan, is there a collaboration? I mean, do folks in that regenerative supply chain, they say, let's get together in a pre-competitive space and collaborate and come up with solutions that drive a more net positive regeneration system.
Yeah.
Do those kind of things exist?
Pick out one thing you just said that I think is cool and important. You used two phrases in your question. You used one earlier, you said regenerative supply chain, and then a little later you said regenerative system. There is no such thing as a regenerative supply chain. In fact, there's no such thing as supply chains in general. We use the term supply chain because we think like machines and we think everything is a machine around us. We say, well, we're hardwired to do this or hardwired to do that. Actually, humans don't have wires. We're not computers. We're not machines. And nature doesn't have any chains in it. There are no chains. There are webs. There are networks. There are systems. But part of the reason that we still say supply chain, and this is difficult in a lot of ways to hear, is because we used to chain people up in order to produce the goods that created our products. And so there's still this mechanistic from the chain and colonial concept that we are pulling things with the chain up from supply. And even though you didn't mean any of that when you said it, and nobody does when they say supply chain, we are unconsciously creating and keeping that chain intact, which is going to make it really hard to regenerate.
But could you explain why? For me, you know, a supply chain is a sequence of steps that get to an outcome. That's why you call it a chain of events. And of course, you could have many supply chains that are a sort of a web. Actually, it's almost like a fishbone diagram that, you know, there's different parts that come together to get to where you want to get to. But why do you say that thinking in terms of supply chains is what is holding us back from thinking about regenerative products?
I mean, you just said part of it, which is you're like, oh, wait, it's not a chain, it's a web. And that is a more accurate representation of how supply systems, is usually the term I use, is a supply system, is how they work. It is a complex, interconnected network that has many nodes that all are communicating and talking to each other in the context of a market and prices. It is a network. And so if we just treat it as a chain, if we think of it as a chain, we tend to oversimplify. We tend to think one-to-one connections. I buy from this person who buys from this person who buys from this person. And that makes it harder to do that pre-competitive collaboration that Jim was talking about, where it's not just about how do I chain up and get my farmers to grow in a certain way. It's like, well, actually, we need to collaborate in the supply shed in the region where all of those growers are growing and help them as a whole enhance and transform their agricultural practices, because then we can lift everybody up and many companies are going to source from that and many farmers are going to benefit from it and many community members benefit from it. And that all happens in a network, not as a one-to-one-to-one connection.
Right.
So yes, yeah, there are many great pre-competitive collaborations out there. One is called the Sustainable Markets Initiative. This is one that Haugud's part of. You can see a couple of great reports we put out for COP over the last few years on scaling regenerative farming. Another is the WBCSD, the World Business Council for Sustainable Development, which especially recently at COP28 in Dubai, I got to be there as they launched the action agenda for regenerative landscapes, which is something that was put forward by the UAE presidency in collaboration with WBCSD. And set targets for the many millions of acres that were going to go into regenerative agriculture. We also see some really great work coming out of the One Planet Business for Biodiversity Coalition, as well as some good thinking recently on financing the transition from the Rockefeller Foundation. So there's a bunch happening and we need more. We kind of have like leading companies who are part of it. We've got Danone, we have Unilever, we have Nestle, we have General Mills all stepping up and sort of pushing it forward. But we need every company. We need every brand. It's got to be like a massive collaboration on a scale that we have not seen before. And it also has to go outside of just the brands and manufacturers. It has to be the ingredient suppliers. We need the ABCDs. We need the traders on board. And some of them are stepping in this direction. We also need the banks. We also need government support. So we basically need a big blended network of coordinated action if we're going to move anything close to fast enough to prevent the really rugged stuff coming from climate change. And
you know, I know a lot of the greener products is that the purchaser, you know, the big company who, you know, designs a product, but also who purchases it, you know, like a Walmart's or in the US, you know, US government's going to be buying sustainable products. And that drives the whole market thing. And you mentioned that just a minute ago, but we have found like in the EU and North America, there's the government making decisions to buy greener products. So if the government makes a decision to buy regenerative foods, that would be a pull for all these brands to do more. Do you see that as a path forward?
Yes, I definitely see that. I would love government procurement to specify, you know, in the United States, they should go with what the USDA calls, you know, movement in this direction, which is climate smart commodities or climate smart agriculture. Mm-hmm. I actually don't care too much what it's called, but that would be a huge step if the government would say, we're only going to buy food that's come out of our Climate Smart Commodities program. And there's some incredible, like the US government just put $2 billion into innovation at the farm level to be moving more in this direction. It's funding a lot of really interesting regenerative agriculture work. That's important. I don't think it's as important as the first thing you said, which is the retailers. And what the retailers, not just Walmart, but all of the retailers choose to do. And I think we're starting to see it. There's some really interesting collaborations. For example, Ahold Delhaize USA has a collaboration they're doing now with Kellanova, with a very iconic product of theirs, and really engaging a full supply system right down to the individual growers, up through the mills, the manufacturing, right into the stores and the storytelling. We're actually going to be hosting. One thing that I do, my role at Haugud is I'm chief innovation officer. And so I both kind of geek out in the regenerative agriculture, the realm that we're in right now, and on product design and data. But then I also help manage our presence and sort of collaboration with these global coalitions we're talking about. That also means at events like the Climate COP or the Biodiversity COP in Colombia, we're going to, or at Climate Week in New York coming up at the end of September. And so we have a house, a sort of a venue. It's called Regen House. You won't be surprised hearing that from me now. So Regen House is in New York City in Climate Week. And one of the evening sessions we're going to do is really focused on this iconic product from Kellanova, but it's in collaboration with the retailer to kind of tell the story and really make the full supply system visible and present so we can see how that collaboration is necessary to move us forward. When retailers head in this direction, that creates a massive market.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think there's two ways to look at this, right? One is you regulate to create a minimum criteria that everybody needs to follow. Don't pollute water. Don't put poison into the soil. And so you create a regulation around that. And so there's some things you can do there. But I think the bigger power is at least outside of the food industry, right? It's in differentiating. It's how do I position my product as being better than others? And in this context, you said there's not so many certifications out there. If you look at other products, there's tons. I think in Europe, there was a survey that was done, 500 certifications or labels that you have out here. What is in it for the product manager to look at regenerative ingredients in their product? What is needed for them to pay more attention to it?
Cool.
Or let's put it, I think that's a wrong, that's two different questions. I think what is needed, I think there's a different thing. Ideally, customers loving it, but customers don't even know what regenerative products mean. So how do you solve that problem?
Yeah? I don't think we have to only have regenerative products. Regenerative products are great. It's an idea. Yeah. We should strive for it. It's fun. We want to go in that direction for sure. But it's not the only path. And it's more like the guiding star to head towards. And along the way, there's a lot of great things we can find. And so I agree, there's too many certifications out there. They're all well-intentioned. Many of them have great value to them. And many of them now do show an uptick in sales. If you have a certified organic product, that's still a very quickly growing category. But I think part of what's happening from the consumer perspective and the retail perspective is it's a little much, 500 different certifications to pay attention to and know what they all mean and know how to differentiate between, you know, if you're in the egg aisle, you know, cage-free, free-range, organic, non-GMO, pasture, but like it's a lot to figure out. So How Good has for a long time been a proponent of a simpler, more unified, very holistic system that takes into account all of environmental and social impacts, but simplifies it down to something that's much quicker to understand. So you could put this in the realm of eco-labeling, where as opposed to many different certifications, there's one unified system that happens throughout an entire grocery store. And so Europe is taking some strides in this, but actually in the US, a number of retailers like Ahold Delhaize, who I've mentioned a few times, they have taken the lead and they have used a system that How Good developed that is very simple. For products, it says good, great, and best just for the top 25% or top 15% or top 5% of products that are out there. That's a combined impact of carbon, water, biodiversity, labor risk, animal welfare, all, you know, very holistic look, but it simplifies it to something that I'm looking at six cheddar cheeses. One of them says, great, I'm going to grab that one. Or we also have some little attributes, some labels that are very simple. They say climate friendly, or they say water smart, really simple things. And wherever we've done trials with these and really done, you know, good, hard science against controls, putting simple, clear, unified across the whole store communication lifts sales. And this is going to your question, Neil, of why should a product manager pay attention to this? Why should they care? Sustainability sells. More sustainable products, products that are further towards regeneration, products that have an attribute that say climate friendly on them, they'll jump in sales. You know, the most recent, we did a trial in the UK. This is published, there's a press release out there about this. Sales jumped 25 to 45% for these different attributes.
The fastest growing sector of all in Germany right now is organic food. And this is organic food. Nobody knows what that means, but it's organic. And there's organic stores all over the place. It's growing faster than any other commodity out here.
And NYU and their sustainability index that they do.
Yeah, the Stern School, right?
That shows 3x category growth. Nielsen did something similar and showed the same growth. So why should managers care? Forget about regeneration. Do you want to make more money? Would you like a better top line revenue? Cool. This is the way to go. This is what millennials want. This is what Gen Z wants. And
70% of buyers in 10 years are going to be those guys.
And then Gen A, right? And at the, I got to go to the IFT conference recently, which was really excellent, the Institute of Food Technologists, where maybe many of your listeners were. And I heard a panel there on Gen A who's coming up, and they really care about sustainability even more. So it's just like, forget all the things about climate change and uplifting species. Just think about the money, and we're going to be heading in a good direction here.
Yeah, I had a follow-on question. Ethan, we've been talking about the upstream, but when I hear a podcast or something in the news, all I hear about is food waste, a major problem we feed the world. Where does that fall in this sort of spectrum of sustainable food?
I don't know. I'm sometimes controversial in this realm. I think that some of the downstream things are like packaging, and food waste. I just think they're a bit of a red herring in terms of where many in the food industry can have potent impact. We should prioritize our efforts and we should allocate resources to change based on the percent of impact that something has in a product's life. So packaging, 3 to 7% of the impact usually comes from packaging. That's about the amount of time, attention, and resources, if we're trying to make a sustainable product, that we should put into packaging, 3 to 7% of our time. Food loss and waste, in the design of a product and a product lifecycle, it's not usually that significant. It's even...
No, but that's downstream, right? So there's a statistic that says 70% of food that is produced never gets eaten. That's a pretty big number. So farm to fork waste. I think that's what Jim mentions. Is there something in terms of product design that allows one to consider this and minimize this?
Not really. From a formulator's point of view, that's not where you have the power to make change. Like, you can use upcycled ingredients. Sure. Upcycled ingredients are great. Upcycled ingredients take what would otherwise be a waste stream and turn them into something. Yes. Mm-hmm. Useful, good thing to do. No problem there. But using a bit of an upcycled ingredient is meaningless if what you also have in your product is palm oil and cocoa. That's where the impact is. 90% of the impact of any food product is in the ingredients, and it's at the growing and production of the ingredients. The fastest thing you can do is change ingredients or change sourcing locations or change ingredient suppliers or change some of the practices of how the food is grown. Those are the biggest levers. And many of those are in the hands of formulators. Switching from palm oil to some other vegetable oils can have a significant positive impact. Switching the location that the palm oil is coming from or the certifications that are with it, you can have a significant impact. So, I mean, there are many tools, there are many colors in the palette of how do you improve the impact of a product, but we should not go with the thing we hear about most or the thing that is marketed the most. We should go based on real hard data of where the impact is in our products. And that's the way to figure out, like, where do I focus my creativity as a formulator and how do I make this product better? Is like, well, where is the impact? Maybe there are some products. If you have a bottle of water, packaging is important because water doesn't have a big footprint. So the packaging is really important if you're making bottled waters or essenced waters or anything like that. Yeah, pay more attention to packaging because there it's 30 to 40% of your impact. But for pretty much all other categories, your biggest bang for your buck is not going to be in the packaging, or it's not going to be in trying to solve food waste.
Yeah, and I think that's the point. When we go back early on in the product sustainability, there was a producer responsibility and product responsibility. And the big debate, Europe had more of a producer responsibility, the U.S. was more of a product responsibility. But I think it's evolved towards the producer responsibility. The producer has responsibility not only for the design, but all the way through the entire life cycle. And so I think what you're arguing here is that from a formulator, it's really the product, you know, the responsibility. I've got responsibility there, but it's a shared responsibility with others. And I think 100%. That's part of the conversation. This goes back to the collaboration on the regeneration, but there's also collaboration and partnership, you know, on the food waste and, you know, sort of the use and end of life of that product, of the food in this case.
Exactly. I don't want to denigrate all the incredible work that's happening on food waste, and I don't want to say it's not important. But I do want to say that for a product formulator, it might not be the place to focus all your energy and effort. And to your point, Jim, yes, let's collaborate with the larger ecosystem to make some motion on that. Also, I mean, I'm a farmer. That's another thing to kind of speak to this food loss and waste thing. I'm a farmer. I have a 30-acre apple orchard, do grass-fed sheep and lamb, grazing in a kind of agroforestry silvopasture way underneath the apple trees. We have shiitake mushrooms. Our farm has multiple other farmers growing vegetables between rows of chestnut trees. They're raising chickens that are rotating through and fertilizing the soil. We have a small integrated, aiming towards regenerative agriculture and farm. Food waste happens on farms. It's not all, like, food waste isn't all evil. Like, yes, there's food that gets produced that does not get eaten on a farm. You know what happens to it? It feeds the chickens or goes into the compost, and that feeds the soil for the next year. So it's like there's a certain degree to which food waste has been vilified, but I also think it has something to do with it puts the problem somewhere else in somebody else's hands instead of grasping changes, big changes that we can make ourselves with what's right in front of us.
I think except for one thing that food formulators could keep in mind, right? And this idea of best before versus used by, which is about the longevity. So how long can you preserve the food product on the shelf? Mm-hmm. And this has to do with what ingredients you put in there, how you package it. Because there's certain packaging that will actually, I mean, we have this huge thing in, had in Germany, right, where we used to package cucumber, every cucumber packaged in plastic. And so we had this huge movement that says, hey, we do not want plastic. And that same cucumber, instead of lasting for 7 to 8 days on the shelf, now lasts 2 days. This is where I think you may do the best. And I think this is not an ingredient. This is not a food product per se, but it's the same thing with biscuits and bread and stuff like that, where by thinking about how you package, thinking about packaging itself may not be the most significant impact, right? But it can influence how much of your food overall actually gets wasted at the end. So I think that is a thing that I worked on, I think probably 15 years ago when we were doing work with some of the big retailers and looking at where is the biggest bang for the buck. And yes, one of them is ingredients. And I think the other is in reducing the amount that actually falls out of this supply web, as you call it.
Yeah. Yeah. I think it's interesting. And then also to speak to this point of collaboration, we've been hitting on another realm that helps with that cucumber that only lasts 2 days. Mm-hmm. This brings it back to regenerative agriculture. We're farming in a more regenerative way, and there's a higher mm-hmm. nutrient density in the foods, which is like, this is a big unlock coming up for the food industry. Like regenerative farming actually produces food that is healthier, that is more nutritious, that has some of the nutrients back in the vegetables and the fruits and the wheat mm-hmm. right, that has degraded over the last 50 years. That will also lead to helping your vegetables that last longer. My cucumbers don't last for 2 days, right? They last for 2 weeks sitting out because of the richness of the soil and what they're coming out of. And so we can do both. And what you're saying definitely makes sense in our situations when you look at the data where that packaging is really important. Mm-hmm. And I think the whole idea here is that we're looking for a polyculture of solutions. Instead of a monoculture in agriculture, there's only one thing growing. It's just corn, or it's just soy, or it's just cucumbers, whatever it is. That's a monoculture, which brings in all of these challenges. It's that same monoculture mind that we were talking about with the chain, where there's just one-to-one-to-one. Instead mm-hmm. of a monoculture, we need a polyculture of solutions all working in a coordinated way together.
Great.
Yeah, no, I like that a lot. One we haven't talked about is social, the workers and child labor and slave labor mm-hmm. kind of thing. I mean, mm-hmm. I'm assuming that's part of the ecosystem of food sustainability.
Yeah, it's part of the eco-social system. It's a big part of what HowGood looks at and thinks about. And there is the danger sometimes if you're only looking at carbon footprint or you're only looking at water, you get that sort of that single topic tunnel vision.
Yep.
And there is then the possibility of actually unintended consequences and doing more harm just focusing on greenhouse gas emissions or carbon. This is part of why HowGood has always from the beginning built into its system the ability to track carbon right alongside human rights and labor risk, right alongside animal welfare. We think this is really essential. We think it's one of the gaps. You know, you see a lot of stuff out there that's like a carbon management platform or carbon accounting, which are good. Don't get me wrong. I like all of them. I want more and more of them. But if you're using AI to just focus on a particular thing that's carbon, you get this thing where you can over-optimize. Just like if you over-optimize for price, then you're going to hit all of the environmental social aspects. If you over-optimize for carbon, you might leave out the labor risk. So yeah, this is a really important thing that we pay attention to and track in the database and want available to everybody. It's also an even more difficult than agriculture thing to work on and to create positive change in.
Sure.
But it's really worth looking at, understanding, and making choices on and towards labor situations that uplift people as opposed to oppress them.
Yeah, and I think that's right. I mean, if you really highlighted the importance of taking a life cycle approach, multiple impacts, not just single impact. So I fully support that.
Ethan, as we come to a close on this, what's the final thought to leave our listeners with?
It's so fun to work in here. Right? You can tell in this conversation we're having, there is great purpose in moving positively for the world. instead of a single bottom line focus, here I go again, monoculture to polyculture. We shouldn't just be focusing on that single thing, even in our own careers. And I find formulators to be so creative, right? You're designers. Like your listeners really design the future of what we're going to eat. And so there's a huge amount of power in your hands. Can't be done alone. Again, you got to collaborate to do it. But like, let's go get access to some good data and make your products better. Go find and make some regenerative ingredients. And I'd be happy and honored to be with you and have our data with you and just come think and play with you on it as much as I can along the way.
Thanks so much, Ethan. And that concludes this episode and our interview with Ethan Soloviev. If you enjoyed this episode and like to get in touch with us, you can reach Neil Jim or I on LinkedIn. We like to hear comments and what you have learned from it. And next episode, we will continue our series of conversations with thought leaders on product sustainability. Thanks and see you then.